a rare AA recording from July 14, 1951. It's co-founder Bill Wilson talking about the birth and publishing of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You may hear a few surprises and a lot of laughs. The recording was made, remember, in 1951 on an old-fashioned wire recorder, so the quality is not up to par. However, it's worth the effort in listening. Here is Bill Wilson and the story of our big book.
Some say that the age of chivalry is gone, that knighthood no longer flowers. But we who come to this Southland as your guests know better. We shan't say any pat things about Southern hospitality, for we have no words to describe it. And when you combine Southern hospitality with AA hospitality in these marvelous confines where we are, the result is an occasion which shall always be stored away as an imperishable memory. Such have been these happy hours to all of us, especially to us Outlanders, and is always the case. We are bound to fetch away more than we have brought. Someday, I suppose, the real story, true story of Alcoholics Anonymous will be put to paper, perhaps generations since. But when that story is finally told, its theme, I am sure, will be this: that Alcoholics Anonymous was a society of immense virtue, of perfect construction, and great power, composed entirely of extremely weak and fallible individuals. That, to my mind, is the true story of Alcoholics Anonymous. For as we know, our fallibilities persist long beyond the day of sobriety. And as time goes on, we marvel on this cathedral of the Spirit, which only God could have wrought. It used to scare me a lot when I heard speakers rise in AA meetings to say that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was an inspired doctrine. To hear clergymen come in and say, "This is of God." Because when I heard such words, I thought of the fallibility, the immense weakness of those of us who engaged in the composition of that book. With great intimacy, I knew all those who wrote the story. And with still more intimacy, I knew myself my immense weakness. So like AA itself, the book turned out to be a very wonderful document composed by an infinitely weak, though well-meaning, crowd of ex-drunks. Last night, we reveled a little bit in some of these yarns on the past, and we jumped over the book episode because I wanted to reserve its lesson for you here tonight. Because it illustrates what great virtue there is in this society arising out of that great heap of failure. And also, because the composition of the book illustrates the purpose of service, which it is now my main motive to make clear to everyone, the idea that AA must function, that it's not just a matter of face-to-face talk with that drunk. Other things have to be done to bring that about, to enable this message to be carried. I hear people say of the General Service Conference, and that body of delegates which will have to be elected and sent up to New York every year, oh, this is too hard. It's too much trouble. Let's keep AA simple. But I fear those who would keep it as simple as that have not a prudent eye on the future. And I assume that they have no idea of the difficulties which God has helped us surmount in creating the services that we already had. Let's take another look at that book deal as a venture in service and a sure proof of the great power of very fallible people when granted the gift of grace. I told you, remember, that in 1938 we encouraged some of Mr. Rockefeller's friends to create this foundation, this great receptacle for the rich to deposit their money in. That, praise God, we were spared the perils of professionalism and of property and of money because Rockefeller, under the guidance of God, I firmly believe, declined to put any money in it, and so did his friends. Therefore, this movement, by his act and the act of all of those people whose money we sought, saved this movement then and there. But here was the foundation, empty of money, but still holding meetings. The meetings began in 1938, and they became commiseration meetings, in which our new friends told us each time how sorry they were that we hadn't got any money together. You remember I explained last night how our grandiose ideas had evaporated. This idea of a lot of paid missionaries and that chain of drunk tanks that I was going to finance a la Wall Street Well, that had evaporated. But we still clung to the notion that we had to have some sort of book. We felt that if we didn't record our experiences in such a book, if we didn't set out clearly the principles of recovery, which we felt had been discovered in their proper application to us, that this whole message would get garbled. And surely all the drunks in the world weren't going to come to Akron, Ohio, or New York City to get well. We owed that much to the million who didn't know. We owed that much to a correct relationship with the world outside, so that people might at least read about what had happened. We had to have a book. Early in 1938, I had composed in rough what were the first two chapters of, to be the first two chapters of that AA book. They were in mimeograph form. They were actually attached to the prospectus that we carried to the very rich who we supposed were going to finance that foundation. But nothing happened. Then came a meeting of the foundation at which Frank Amos, one of our good friends, still a trustee, said, "Bill, why don't you take those two proposed book chapters down to my friend at Harper's, Gene Axeman, the religious editor, and see what he thinks about it." Well, I'd never written anything, for with trepidation I lugged in the mimeograph copy of those chapters. Axeman looked them over, and right away brightens up. He said, "Why, Mr. Wilson," he said, "that's rather interesting. Could you do a whole book like this?" So I lied valiantly and said, "Oh, of course, of course." Then he intimated that I might have something like $1,500 as an advance royalty if I could complete the book by the spring of 1939. It then being late summer of 38. Oh, that was great news. And by this time, $1,500 looked like $15,000. Lois was still in that department store. I did get her out later, however. Quite a lot later. Well, as I walked away from Harper's, my spirits began to droop again. I thought to myself, well, now, if we take this $1,500 grubstake and eat that up while this book is being written, that'll be an advance royalty. So for quite a while after the book comes out, there may not be any more royalty. And what are we going to eat on then? And besides, supposing the magazines and newspapers began to print pieces, a lot of inquiries came in. How would we hire the help to answer them? And then the idea burst upon me, why don't we drunks publish this book ourselves? The deuce with Harper's. The dickens with Mr. Rockefeller and his pious ideas about money. We drunks will become the publishers of this book. Well, at that time, I had a chum in AA by the name of Hank. Hank had been sober a year or two. He'd once been a prominent Standard Oil executive. And he was a promoter deluxe. So I go to Hank. Hank says, "Wonderful." The next step, he and I walk into a stationery store. We buy a pad of stock certificates. We write across the top of these blank certificates, Works Publishing, par value $25. The idea of Works Publishing was that this book was to be the first of many great works, you see. Of course, only two chapters done, but never mind. So here was Works Publishing Company, $25 par value. And we began to carry these shares in the book not yet written to the local drunks around New York City and their immediate friends and relatives. Well, we hadn't had so much experience up to then in soliciting money from drunks, and the drunks, to put it bluntly, gave us just one hell of a chill. They said, what a nerve, what a promotion, for God's sake, to buy stock in a book not yet written. Well, we could see if we kept selling these certificates that would mean a continuous meal ticket. And we might sell enough of those shares so as to get the money to print the book 9 months hence. So the first effort at selling the shares of the Works Publishing Company was an awful bust. But as I say, Hank was a super promoter, and I spent years in Wall Street, and we said, well, these drunks are tough customers, Hank, but there is some way on getting the pry on them. Now, there's some kind of a hook we could use. So then we came back with the argument, but look, Harper says that this is going to be a wonderful book. This conservative religious publishing house, Harper's, they're willing to put $1,500 up on this book. What's the matter with you drunks? $25 a share. In fact, you can buy it on installments, $5 a month, and Hank will collect the money while I'm writing, see? No, sir. Well, then we go around to a printer and we find out something very wonderful from the promotion point of view. In those days, you know, the dollar was really worth something. And we found that you could get a book about the size of the one we projected printed for something around 35 cents a copy. So then we looked up in the New York Times Book Review and we priced textbooks in there. And we found that the cheapest textbook you could get, this was to be no novel, of course, the cheapest one was $3. The most expensive one listed there was some around $5. We said, now we got it. There's millions of this. Oh, very spiritual we were, I assure you. We print the damn book for 35 cents and we sell them for $3.50. That'll get the drunks. We can show them how we'll move carloads of these books. Print them for 35 cents. Direct mail, sure cure for drunks, $3.50. Can't miss drunks. Well, we go back with the Works Publishing shares again to the clientele. No sale. Meanwhile, Hank and I were getting in very bad odor. See, up to this time, I had been talking about that hot flash of mine all the time. Folks had gotten me into kind of an ivory tower, and here I was around peddling stock certificates to eat on, in a book not yet written. So we said, well, there's some way to fetch these stingy bums. So we went up to the Reader's Digest, Hank and I did. We go to the managing editor, Kenneth Payne. We said to Mr. Payne, well, here is the work that's gone on. About 40 drunks sober. Not a great number, but Mr. Payne, a very significant number. This is one of the most fatal maladies that has ever afflicted mankind. Harry's time elapsed on 40 cases. Besides Miss Payne, we have excellent approval in high court. And we told him in a discreet way, confidentially, about our close friendship with John D. Rockefeller. And how I talked with Harry Emerson Fosdick, and he thought this was good. Mr. Payne, the managing editor, took fire. Why, he said, Mr. Wilson, he said, this is just exactly the kind of thing the Reader's Digest would like. We'd love to do a piece about your promising young society. One alcoholic talking to another. Oh, very dramatic. Yes? We'll put a feature right on. Well, we said, please, Mr. Payne, not right now. This society is now preparing a book which will appear sometime next spring, long 39, and we'd like to wait until the book is done because a piece in the digest would bring in thousands of inquiries, and we need to have our method set down on paper. So at this juncture, Mr. Payne going along with that, I said, and Mr. Payne, in case your feature writer does a piece about this book, about this movement of ours, say in 1939, of course you'd mention our new book, wouldn't you? Oh, yes, he said. When do you expect to have it done? Well, long around April, May 1939. Said, fine, it's a deal. So then we go back to the drunks, and we say, now look, we print them for 35 cents. We sell them direct mail sure cure for drunks, $3.50. Harper says it's going to be a good book. And moreover, even if it's a lousy book, that piece in the Reader's Digest will move them out by carloads drunks, and you'll not only get your money back, you'll double it, you'll quadruple it. In fact, there might be millions in this. What about some Works Publishing share? $25 a pound. And we began to peddle the stock, which meant that Lois and I began to eat again on the stockholders' money. It meant that we hired little Ruthie Hawk, our first secretary, you know, who was taking the dictation on the book. I couldn't write it, of course. I had to talk it. He ate out of all this because he had to collect the money. And believe it or not, between September 1938 and April 1939, out of that little bunch of drunks and their friends, 49 of them all told, we actually sold $4,900 worth of publishing stock. Stock in a book not yet written on which they would make millions. Now, they were the haves, only one-third interest, the 49. And for services rendered, you know, I took myself a third. Hank, he collected the money. That was a very valuable service indeed. He took a third. So it was two-thirds water and $4,900 drunk's money. So that is how the book venture started. It was all very spiritual, I assure you. Well, meanwhile, our new friends, the trustees, thinking they had advised us very well on money once, which they did, tried to do it again. And they said, why, this will never work, says Mr. Rockefeller's friends. Can't be done. Authors never publish books and get away with it. We've inquired about this. We think you're on the wrong track. Well, politely but pointedly, we reminded them there was no money in the damn foundation, And why hand this wonderful new coming book to Harper's? Shouldn't our society own it, or at least stockholders? Well, so the preparation of the book went on. And a chapter would be roughed out. And we would send it out to Smithy in Akron, and he'd peddle it around out there. It'd peddle around the chapters in the little meetings in our parlor at Clinton Street, Brooklyn. And the drunks would paw and claw these chapters, these roughs over. And I soon discovered I wasn't the author of this text at all. I was just the umpire out of the tremendous number of fights we had about it. Oh, it was a very spiritual operation. Meanwhile, I got to the place in the book where you had to begin to tell them what it was all about. I'd got my story written and that introductory chapter, and I don't know, we'd softened up the agnostics, and when were we going to get out of cases? So one night, under very spiritual auspices, suffering from an awful case of self-pity, the stockholders weren't coming through at the moment, lying abed in pain from one of my psychosomatic imaginary ulcer attacks, I commenced to write what are called 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only reason for making a number of steps was this. We'd got a little cynical about drunks then. We realized that they were rationalizers. And we said this word-of-mouth program is too brief, and the truth is thrown at them in big chunks. You better handle them teeth, see, and then put them on a track so that they can't possibly run off it if they keep going. So we'll say, yeah, we admitted we are hopeless, and we'll get honest with ourselves, we'll make a confession, we'll make restitution, and we'll pray as best we can, and we'll help other people without demand for reward. That's the word-of-mouth program. But let's bust it up into littler pieces so that these readers out there at a distance can't miss a trick, can't wiggle out of it. So in about a half an hour, grousing a good deal about the stockholders as I wrote, all was very inspired, I tell you. I wrote the 12 steps of the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And they became, as you know, the basis for the next two or three chapters in the book. And presently, after I put it through a typing or two, I brought it around to a meeting, and all hell broke loose. 12 steps. What do you mean, 12 steps? We got well on 6 steps. Who the hell do you think you are? 12 steps. Same thing out of Akron. The drunks rent them 12 steps all in small pieces. Besides, they said you got to last up with God all the way down. One day you're talking about this big hot flash you got and loading everybody with a lot of this God stuff, and the next day you're out selling them stock shares. Now you got 12 steps instead of 6. Let's keep it simple, they said. Well, I took a bit of persuasion. And we finally hit on one little compromise about those 12 steps. I had loaded it up with God pretty heavy. So one of the boys says, why don't you give them mint, apple, and plum? On the theory that if mint gives them a bellyache, well, they can have some apples, see? In other words, why don't you you can put in a little about God, but throw in some stuff about that higher power and a power greater than yourself. God as we understand him. So that was the compromise between my hot flash and more realistic drunks than I was. And very grudgingly I made it, which was the only change. Inspirational steps were restless. and finally approves after a perfectly hellish fight. Well, of course, we'd only just got going.
Meanwhile, Hank was out
peddling the certificates every day.
And it got to be very complicated
because they were all nearly all out
buying them on installments.
Some guys would buy $25 share.
$5 a month.
See? And you had to go around. He was a collection agency.
But he was
eating good all the time. He couldn't kick.
And I was a
writing away and arguing away with these drunks about the book. So by and by, we get near completion. Smithy, out in Akron, he'd gone around and collected a parcel of stories.
About 30 stories in the book, you know,
and about 3/5 of them came from Akron. The other 2/5, excepting one
from Cleveland,
where they still think they began. Two-fifths of them came from New York.
So the
stories got in, and then, of course, we went through another hell of a time. Because authors who were not hardened writers are very sensitive about editing and cutting and deleting and trimming and having suggestions made to them.
Well, when you have 30
drunken authors
and they write the tremendous stories of their own lives, and some other drunk starts to cut and mark them up,
you can just imagine how spiritual the atmosphere was when we were corrected. But at length, about January,
the thing was
fairly well in the bag. And then we got awful cautious. We woke up to the fact that none of us knew much about religion.
We didn't know.
At that time, we didn't have any
psychiatric
victims around like Ruth to refer to. And we wondered how
this document was going to
stop.
Besides,
some of the principles, you know, the bigger chunks of truth,
had been abstracted from
the Oxford group through my friend Abby, who came to me. We'd learned
from those good people both
what and what not to do. And meanwhile, the Pope had he'd
written off the Oxford group,
and
while we were now very much
different,
we had a big scare.
And we said, my God, all these Kylers and Hops to come, if the Pope writes them off, we're going to be in an awful fix. This book has got to satisfy the Irish.
Moreover,
and even worse, it has got to satisfy the
secularist.
And most of all, it has to satisfy that drunk out of today. So how are we going to keep out of denominational trouble and have we fed on anybody's porn? Boys, we better peddle some more of them worse publishing stairs.
And we better make a pre-publication copy of the book,
which with a good deal of labor was done. About 400 copies.
They're the real museum pieces.
So we hand them out to doctors,
psychiatrists,
housewives,
fishwives,
and with great trepidation, we laid hold of the only Irishman we had who had just come out of Greystone Asylum, and we sent him over to the Catholic Committee on Publications in New York to see what the committee thought about it.
Well, of course, we all had a bad case of the jitters.
By some strange coincidence, we didn't just have any Catholic members. Only one Macron.
And we just got one in New York. This guy Morgan, who becomes quite the hero of this tale.
So our friend Morgan Ryan, he knows somebody on the committee. You know how them Irishmen are. And he sneaks it over into the committee, and the committee takes a look at it. after a while, Morgan comes down and he said, gee, he said, it got by. Boy, he said, it got by in a how. He said, of course, the bishop ain't going to put any imprimatur on it, but it's all in the clear. So the committee called in Mr. Ryan and they said, now, this is an admirable work. Church will have no objection to it. In fact, we have only one absolutely necessary change that has to be made in this book for Catholic reasons. So Mr. Ryan said, well, what is it? Well, he said, right here in the first chapter, called Bill's Story, you'll find near the end a statement which reads like this. And they turned to the chapter which read, in a burst of extravagance, of course, a rhetorical flourish, I have finished the chapter by saying, we have found heaven right here on this good old earth. So Morgan's three friends on the committee looked at him and they said, now, Morgan, couldn't Mr. Wilson just shift that a little bit? He said, couldn't he change that word heaven to utopia? After all, we clergymen are promising folks something much better later on. Moreover, we don't require it. And the chapter on meditation and prayer is perfect from the Catholic viewpoint, but maybe here are a few little improvements or whatever. Well, they were the improvements for God, and we slapped them right in. So now the great day has arrived. But the money, the stockholders' money, the trickle had got right down to just a drop at a time. There was very little in the bank. So we thought we'd better go over to the printer and see what could be done. We were ready to go to press. Well, through an introduction, we got to one of the very big commercial printers, Cornwall Press. President turned out to be an awful nice gent, as you will see. And he said to us, well, he said, sure, of course, we'll print the book, but here's what it'll cost, about 35 cents a copy, provided you get quite a few printed. Be somewhat higher, unless. Says, about how many of these books do you folks want printed? Well, of course, we said we only got 100 members in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, we thought we'd call this book 100 Men, but we had one alcoholic woman and she squawked, and so we called it Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, he said, how many do you want? Oh, well, we said the market's going to be very big. Reader's Digest is going to print this piece. They got 12 million circulation. These books will go right out in Carnival. And then we said, of course, we have this nice connection with Mr. Rockefeller. Well, he said, what about the money? He said, how much you got to put on the line? Oh, well, we said, currently, we don't, the bank account just a little bit low, but we could put a few $100 down, and of course, you can easily see that thing's going to move out. And besides, our friendship with Mr. Rockefeller, you know, if we really got put to it. So he printed up 5,000 copies of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Then Hank and I went up to the Reader's Digest to see the managing editor, Mr. Payne. We walked into Mr. Payne's office. All bright and glowing, I said, well, Mr. Payne, the job is done. We're all ready to shoot. Mr. Payne gave us a rather blank stare, and he said, gentlemen, shoot what? Oh, what a thinking thing. Shoot what? Oh, he said, yes. He said, I remember you fellas. You were in here last fall, weren't you? Said, you're those, you're members of that society of alcoholics helping each other. Oh, dear me, he said, I'm really so sorry about this. He said, shortly after you went away, I made the proposal in an editorial meeting, and all the other editors disagreed with me. Gee, he said, I thought this was a good idea. He said, none of them liked it at all. They said, there isn't any public interest in drunks at all. It's a taboo subject. This society of yours might prove awfully controversial medically and religiously. Frankly, we decided way back last fall that we couldn't do the piece, and we forgot to let you know. Oh. And we had $4,900 of them drunks' monies, 5,000 books in the warehouse, and at that juncture, the bank foreclosed on the Wilson's house in Clinton Street, Brooklyn, and we were set out in the street. Such was the state of Alcoholics Anonymous and the book Alcoholics Anonymous at the end of 4 years of this mission. Well, how could we go back and face the drunks that we had abstracted $4,900 from 49 of them? Well, one drunk said, okay, see if you can pick up the pieces. I'll let you have the use of my summer camp. Another drunk lent us an automobile. We put our stuff in storage on the cuff. Couldn't even pay the truckman. People began to pass the hat. $50 a month came in for groceries. When it got too cold in the summer camp, Lois and I began to live in one AA's house and then the next. And so we lived for several years. Well, meanwhile, the printer, he got a little restless and began to ask us about that Rockefeller connection. What about a little money? Meanwhile, we hadn't heard anything from Mr. Rockefeller, you remember, since 1937. And at that time, he wasn't favorable on the money. Well, of course, our friends, the trustees, kind of politely said, well, we told you so. Well, we got frantic then. The sheriff actually moved in on that little office over north where a good deal of this work was done. Of course, we were out of our house. Hank was soon put out of his place. And the printer, he began to say, well, maybe I'll have to take this book over. Well, we knew we just had to get some publicity to move some of those damn books. Meanwhile, here were 49 griping drunks, and the word had spread to Akron that this was a New York racket which had gone sour, and that was communicated to Cleveland, where the legend has been carried ever since. So we made a hasty canvas of all the magazines that published in New York City. Nobody would print one single piece about Alcoholics Anonymous. When all of a sudden our hero of Greystone Asylum, Irishman number one in the New York group, Mr. Ryan, said, gee, he said, why didn't I think of it? I got a wonderful idea. He said, you know, of course, I used to be a big shot in the ad business. I will be soon again, but I used to know Gabriel Heater. He's putting on those 3-minute interviews. You know, human interest stuff. And he pulls the old stop right out, too. 96 station hookup. I'll go over and see Gabriel. Boys, we'll move these books in carloads. Don't worry. So, Gabriel, and Gabriel said, why, sure. Morgan, I'm delighted to see you. Of course, I'll put on an interview in about 2 weeks. Come on here. Here's the, put you right down for it now. Ryan came back, all arranged. Gabriel Heater will interview me about the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our wonderful new book, Sure Cure for Alcoholism. 96 station hookup. All the drunks brightened up. Again, we can see the books going out in carloads. Carload lots. We even thought we'd give the printer another order if he'd stand for it. Get ready. So, all of a sudden we had a terrible chill. We said to ourselves, this guy Ryan has only been out of Greystone Asylum 3 months now. Made up, and we time it with the broadcast. So that just before here's broadcast hit, 2 weeks hence, a postal charge shower will hit every doctor east of the Mississippi. 20,000 of them. And the postal card will say, listen to Gabriel Heather on Alcoholics Anonymous. No cure for alcoholism hits the world. Buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous, $3.50. Sure cure for alcoholism. Hank said, gee, we ought to do that. So we gambled our last cent on the postal card show. Sure enough, Mr. Ryan kept sober. He had to. And the great night came. You see, at that time, there wasn't a very big market in AA for the books because we had only 100 members. And 49 members who had bought stock all had free books. And the 30 members who had put in the stories, they also had free books, so that made 79 books that were free and 100 members. But again, we could see him going out in carload lots. Gabriel Heater, 96 station hookup. The drunks had got all their ears glued to the receivers. Akron, Cleveland, New York. Will Ryan show up? Will he make it? Yes, sir, and then we hear Heater come on, and boy, Heater pulled the old stop right out. Ryan told him how he came out of the asylum, how hopeless he was, how the doctors had pronounced him incurable. And, said Heater, Mr. Ryan, how long have you been sober? And Ryan said, about 3 months. So, that said, Ryan, there are plenty more, sober 2 or 3 years. Sure for alcoholism, Mr. Heater. Well, we just couldn't wait for the book orders to come in. We had a post office box, then Church Street Annex post office. You'll see it in the first couple editions. We couldn't wait that 4 or 5 days for all them doctors to send in those thousands of book orders. $3.50 we were going to get for those, no cheap books either. $3.50. 35 cents for them. We went over to the post office box, Hank and little Ruthie Hot and me. I had that funny stinking sensation again. In the box you could see a few little postal cards. But Hank, he was always an optimist. Hank said, hell, Bill. He said, don't worry. He said, they couldn't get all that stuff in the box. He said, they got bags and bags and bags out there. So, we went to the window. Hank said brightly, well, how about the mail in box 658? Kirk bought us 12 postal cards. Hank said, well, where's the rest? Have you got some more bags of these out here? No. I remember how we took those 12 postal cards and spread them out on the glass top desk in that downtown coastal. And 10 of them were from doctors so drunk they couldn't write at all, and we had exactly 2 book orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, boy, we were both prepared. And everybody said, I told you so. Well, we kept something to come. Finally, we got Liberty Magazine, Promise of Peace. And who do you suppose promised them? A very well-known character in American life who has good reason to be interested in AA, although he's not a drunk himself. no less guy than Fulton Osler, the notary's author, and today of the Reader's Digest, then the managing editor of Liberty. And he put Morris Markey, a freelancer, on it, but it was only about June 1939 then, and they couldn't publish until the next September, this story. Well, of course, with this definite promise from the Reader, Liberty Magazine, we couldn't miss. The books would be going out in carload lots, of course, in September, but this was only June. Meanwhile, the sheriff had moved in our office. We'd snuck out of that building and into another one, into a little cubicle over there in Newark. Ruthie Hawk was working with no pay. Lois and I were in the summer camp. The drunks were passing the hat. And how are we going to stave off the prince? He was really getting restless by now. So I went over to a friend of mine, an old-time AA in New York, named Bert Taylor. Bert had inherited a very fashionable tailoring shop on Fifth Avenue, but there was nothing left to it but the front. He drunk up all the rest. Of course, Bert has a few very fashionable customers. In fact, some of the rock throwers. So Bert was our shining capitalist at the moment. I went to Bert, who had purchased some stock in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I think he was a big stockholder. He had 4 shares. I said to Bert, look, Bert, Liberty is going to publish in September. The books will then move out in carload lots. But Bert, we got to have $1,000 to tide it over. Could you dig that up somehow? And Bert said to me, are you sure that Liberty is going to publish in September? You know how the Digest deal came out. Oh, yes, we can't miss Bert. Well, Bert was an optimist. He said, you know, I got a lot of rich customers. I'll call one up. So I got on the telephone and called up a man in Baltimore, a certain Mr. Cochran. Cochran is interested in Texas. Oh, I said, Bert, but be careful. I mean, we don't want to get mixed up with this drive business. Listen, says Bert, do you want that $1,000 or don't you? So Bert said to his friend, Mr. Cochran, you probably heard me tell about that new society. I'm a member in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how interested you are in alcoholism. Mr. Cochran, it just occurred to us that maybe you'd be interested in this book of ours called Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure for alcoholism, Mr. Cochran. And we think that you might be interested in placing a copy of this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in a number of public libraries. We have published a limited edition of this, Mr. Cochran. We have only 5,000 copies on hand, but we would be willing to let you have a couple thousand copies. Say cheap, around $2, although the actual price $3.50, for this good and charitable purpose, when you put them out in the library. Mr. Cochran, no, he didn't think he'd care for that. So Bert said, well, Mr. Cochran, our society has a publishing company known as Works Publishing Company, the publisher of this book. And he said, our capital at the present time is mostly in the form of these books. And we have a piece coming out in fall in Liberty Magazine, which of course will move these 5,000 books and many more. And frankly, we need about $1,000 to tide us over. Would you lend the Works Publishing Company $5,000? Well, said Mr. Cochran, a very practical man, he said, what does the balance sheet of Works Publishing Company look like? So Bert told him, and he said, no, I don't think I'd care for any of that. So then Bert said, look, Mr. Cochran, you know that I have a large and prosperous business here. And Mr. Cochran, of course, was impressed by the front room and knew nothing of Bert's banking situation. He said, well, of course. Well, said Bert,
Mr. Cochran, will you lend me the money, $1,000, and I, in turn, will lend it to the works publisher?
Why, of course, said Mr. Cochran.
Send me your note. So Bird shipped Mr. Cochran a note on an already bankrupt business and got $1,000, which saved the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, it was all very spiritual, people, in those days. Very spiritual. Then comes the Liberty Fee. 800 inquiries come in. Some books move out. The 100 of us start to mushroom. By the spring of 1940, we had jumped to 800 members. We sold enough books to just keep the printer happy. The stockholders were terribly restive. They were supposed to get the money back and keep the stock too, you know. Then in 1940, as I told you last night, Mr. Rockefeller gave a dinner to all these banker boys. And we thought our money troubles were all over. But no, they weren't. But Mr. Rockefeller at that time gave of himself. And he had it put on the AP and UP wires that he had given this dinner. And the Daily Mirror in New York said John D. Jr. dined toss pots. At any rate, word went out to the world that AA was on the level. And a lot of people began to sneak into the bookstores to get hold of this book that John D. inferentially recommended. So we moved quite a few books. And then in 1941, the deluge. Jack Alexander printed his piece about Alcoholics Anonymous. Thousands of frantic inquiries came down on us. The AA book began to move. It paid off the stockholders. It bought in their stock. The two promoters, Hank and me, donated our stock to the foundation so that today you own this book through the foundation, you, the members of AA. And Doc Smith was given a royalty of 35 cents on a book, and I was given a royalty of 35 cents on the book, and the foundation made a buck, and you groups who sell the book, you made a buck. That's how the book deal wound up. And today, my only income is still the royalty on the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But folks, I got a raise now. Every time that one of you drunks buy that book, I've got you for 52 and a half cents. And you send it. Does not that account so well show the workings of divine providence in our behalf? Here is world acclaim for this society. Here are the Jesuits who say that that book is perfect Catholicism, but so do the Christian scientists. So do all the Protestant religions. We even had a Hindu princess who come on from India a while back, and she said that it was good Hindu. What are the claim for this society and for that book? The governor of this state comes in and said this is the greatest humanitarian movement of our time. Yes, I think we can rightly say that Alcoholics Anonymous is a great and perfect gift. A society of immense perfection, still composed of very fallible people who have been able to do the impossible under the grace of God. So at this hour of parting, which is not goodbye but au revoir, let us calmly regard our future. Let our gaze be fixed on the highway leading to the east toward the sunrise. And may we soon meet you there.